Tune to KV Mark. FM, Nevada City, KCPC Camino with translators K286 AM, Truckee 105.1 FM, K258 DG Angels Camp at 99.5 FM, and K230 CO Woodland 93.9 FM. Big thanks to Jen for another edition of Gene Walk. That's one of my favorite shows here on KVMR. Let's take care of some business and we'll go on with the show. My name's Mark Cuniberti. Thanks for joining me today. Big thanks goes out to Foothill Flowers and the Johnson family, celebrating 52 years of providing a wide variety of flowers and supporting Nevada County's nonprofits in our community with flower arrangements. Located on Main and Auburn in downtown Grass Valley, foothillflowers.com. And the Zelmer Law Group, a real estate and business law firm with offices in Nevada City and Santa Rosa. Mr. Jay Zelmer has been practicing law in California since 1983. Broad Street, Nevada City, ZelmerLawGroup.com. And also thanking California Solar Electric Company, Grass Valley-based, providing local power to local people since 2000, a SunPower Elite dealer designing and installing residential off-grid and commercial systems. California Solar Electric Company at CaliforniaSolar.com. And thanking Robert W. Baird and Company, the Lee and Dunn Group, John Lee, Janice Dunn, and Margie Dieterman, providing comprehensive financial advice and services to individuals, families, businesses, and foundations on Sierra College Drive, Grass Valley, BairdFinancialAdvisor.com/Lee Dunn Group. And thanking Olympia Mortgage and Investment Company in Grass Valley for over 15 years, specializing in diversified mortgage pool investments. Real estate direct broker license 01325631.omici.com. And finally, thanking Briar Patch Community Cooking School, where participants can create new meals, snacks, and more scratch in a home kitchen located at 548 Zion Street in Nevada City. Class schedule and registration online at briarpatch.coop. Welcome to the 272nd show of your economic forum entitled Money Matters. My name's Mark Cuniberti. Thanks for joining me today, edition of Money Matters. Today, annuities, planning, and how to build a portfolio, among other things. Big thing happened in the market today. I'll tell you that in a second. But before we begin, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions, only the opinions of the authors or guests that I may read or have on the show. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. Blah, blah, blah. So money matters. It's about money. As money does matter, and the matters of money affect us all in some way or another, whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it. It controls our economy, our country, our planet, in some way or another, controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, it's about you. And why is money important? I've always said, hey, man, we have dropped an atomic bomb, two of them on Japan. We've seen wars, bird flu, pestilence, plagues. None of those can wipe out a country. They can, but so far they haven't. Economic collapse, on the other hand, has. It's one that is a common thread of collapsing countries, economies, civilizations, economic collapse, Rome. I mean, we could just go down through the list. So that's why it's important we pay attention to the economy. The economy can basically submarine the rest of us. So news out today, pretty big news. For me, it's pretty big news. Out on YahooFinance.com. FinanceYahoo.com. President Trump criticized the Federal Reserve's interest rate increases. President Trump criticized the Federal Reserve's interest rate increases, breaking with more than two decades of White House tradition of avoiding comments on monetary policy out of respect for the independence of the U.S. Central Bank. In other words, we don't like to see, or the general thinking is, we don't like to see a president manipulating or in any way that could be construed as influencing the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve is supposed to be independent. Is the Federal Reserve independent? Ha! Yeah, you tell me. But, you know, all these things on the surface, you know, we have to pretend. So, there's a quote here, but it really doesn't say... Oh, here it is. Okay. Trump, quote, "I'm not thrilled," unquote. "The Fed is raising borrowing costs and potentially slowing the economy," he said in an interview with CNBC broadcast Thursday. Today, before we go up, and every time you go up, they want to raise rates again. I don't really, dash, I'm not happy about it. But at the same time, I'm letting them do what they feel is best. I have a hammer. I'm going to hit you, but go do whatever you want. He also said, "But I don't like all this work that's going into doing what we're doing," Trump said on CNBC. Fed has raised rates five times since Trump took office in January 17th, with two of those coming this year under Chairman Jerome Powell, the president's pick to replace Janet Yellen, Yellow Yellen, as I coined her. In the interview, Trump called Powell a very good man. So, it, you know, on the surface, you know, they're complaining, but really, we all know that the Federal Reserve, at least in my opinion, is not independent. So, interesting. Okay, so missed a month here. Thanks for joining me. Welcome back. And high on the Dow is 26,616. Low, 23,005, as mentioned on the show and previously approved. To illustrate to you, I didn't think the correction was going to be serious. 5 was needed. 10 happened. I always thought 10 was also going to be okay, and I published such and also was approved. And it was 10 point something. And so in my opinion, you know, this thing, you know, could be go back to 26,16 and beyond. Remember, nobody can tell you which way markets go. It is my opinion only. It may not necessarily be the reflect of the people that I work for and the station, but those are my opinion only. So these big numbers, 25,000, 26,000, 24,000, 23,000, those are the big numbers. They're called resistance and support at 25,076. 25,076, 25,000 under us is support. So if we fall under 25,000 and stay there for a prolonged period of time, or close there on a Friday, or close there on a particular day, some technicians would say that that would be a weak sign. If it bounces off 25,000 and bounces again, keeps bouncing and then runs, people would say that the support level held. Support level held. So U.S. markets close in 45 minutes. You're listening to us on July 19th, 2018, the year of alert on Thursday, 12:16 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Show is carried on about 65 other stations at different times. So the time you hear the show, if it is not noon Pacific time on Thursday, July 19th, you will be hearing a recorded version of it. And the indices that I am reiterating may not be accurate at the time of you hearing it. And you can call in any time, 530-265-9555, if you're listening to the show live, 530-265-9555. Don't guarantee I can put you on the air, but I will try, and so on and so forth. Okay, so we'll see, you know, NASDAQ down 32. Don't know what's moving the markets, probably more of this tariff action. You know, I deal with... I deal with a lot of companies. I have another company that... that oversees the buying of engineering materials, such as pumps and motors and valves and pipes. And I have seen through the tariffs. I didn't think I'd see it, but just today, somebody jacked a price on me and said it was because of the tariffs. And some people who had already quoted something to a company and your quote is binding for 30 days have seen. Today, I heard as much as a 20% increase. Ouch. If I had a 20% profit and I saw a 20% increase because of the tariffs, ouch. And I had mentioned on previous shows, I, myself, am not a fan of tariffs. That's basically charging more for something that's coming in from overseas if it's an import tariff. I am a fan of tax credits. I have covered that in articles and on this show multiple times. Because tariffs, as is generally thought, increases the prices of everything. They may protect the U.S. steel companies. That's questionable, in my opinion. But it's commonly believed that the tariffs increase the price of everything. Where tax credits would accomplish the same thing for our steel companies, you could give them a tax credit or give American companies a tax credit. And they would still get in a better position of advantage that way. But in that particular case, you don't pay more for stuff. And I don't pay more for stuff. Tax credits means that the United States government doesn't get as much money. So everybody's always talking about tariffs. In my opinion, tariffs are horrible. They cause inflation. And we've seen many articles come on inflation taking off. And I just saw it on Yahoo Finance just 2 days ago. Their head lead going into the evening markets was things are costing more. I think you've seen that. And so, there you go. So we'll watch the market. Dow down 121. GE, the dog of the Dow. And that is not a recommendation to buy or sell any security. But GE is basically, had real, not really good stock performance. I don't have to tell you that. Just look it up and see for yourself. GE is posting, I believe, after the close today. So we'll see whether GE can get his act together and post some good numbers. Do you buy a stock when it's all beat up, or do you sell a stock when it's all beat up? I'm looking at a chart that goes back to July 22nd, 2013. The high for GE was somewhere around 31. Today it's sitting at 13. Wow. It's also been removed from the Dow 30. And so there you go. AT&T flat up 30, but down 34 cents. McDonald's at a nickel up. Pfizer 0.26 down, 26 cents. Intel 0.9 cents down, and Apple up $1.47 at 191.87. And so there you go. We will see. We'll see. So we'll see what happens. Welcome back. Thank you very much. Thanks for tuning in. And so I want to talk to you. We'll first talk to you. We're going to talk about portfolios. But I first want to talk about annuities. So let's first tell you what an annuity is about. And I must tell you that prior, when I submitted this article to the regulators, they said that I had to emphasize in print the disclaimer. So on the air, I'm going to emphasize it twice, okay? Once before I read it and once after to make sure the regulators are happy. So before I get into annuities, the emphasis is, in bold, investors should consider their investment objectives, risk, fees, and expenses before investing. For this and other important information, please obtain the investment company fund prospectus and disclosure documents from your rep advisor. Read this information carefully before investing. Guarantees are based on the claims paying ability of the issuing insurance company. The views expressed are the opinions of myself and our opinions only, and again, should not be construed as acted upon on individual investment advice. All right? Indexes may not be invested in directly, and consider consulting a qualified financial advisor if you have questions or concerns and before making any investment decision. Okay, so there's my disclaimer. I'll read it again at the end of this brief discussion about annuities. I wasn't a big fan of annuities for the longest time. I was not a big fan of annuities for the longest time. I saw too many of them with high fees, complicated terms, and so many hooks. I had to get out my tackle box to house them all. So many hooks, I had to get out the fishing box to put them all in. That said, when I started offering annuities to clients with specific needs and desires, not too long ago, about a year and a half ago, I think, 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I reviewed literally hundreds of them, and in the pile, I found a few I thought advantageous. First off, the description of an annuity that I like to use is a contract between an insurance company and you, or person, that stipulates in return for a sum of money paid by you or an investor, the company, insurance company, in return will promise payments over a period of time. Or they may just promise a lump sum at the conclusion of the contract. The contract is the annuity. So when you take it out an annuity, it is a contract. Needless to say, annuities have all sorts of versions and terms, but just know that the contract, the annuity, is a promise to pay to you, to the investor, from the insurance company, because you paid them. How, when, and how much they pay you depends on the contract. The promise of the annuity, the contract, is as good as the company making it. So realize they are not guaranteed by the U.S. government in any way, shape, or form. You can pay the company, the annuity company, the insurance company, a sum in a lump, or you can pay them over time. The annuity can be tied to a moving target, such as a stock index, or can be tied to a fixed rate of return. We promise to give you this. There are other variations, and they literally come in all shapes and sizes. I mean, literally, they come in so many flavors. Needless to say, just know that when I look at them, you know, my head spins. Without getting too technical, annuities can have a tie-up period with a client, you, commits to leaving at least some of the money, if not all, with the company for a specified length of time. Some allow a portion of money to be taken out at certain times at the client's option. In other words, you put a bunch of money in. Some annuity contracts allow you to take some back out if you need it, okay, without penalty. Some allow you to take out some without penalty over time. There are most have a hardship clause that allows for special circumstances such as the death of somebody in the contract, a specific person, not everybody in the contract, but, you know, somebody that would affect the contract. I find myself as an advisor that investors who want a steady stream of income later in life that won't go away. For instance, you can't outlive your money. They'll keep paying you until you go 4 feet up. Or an investor that cannot stomach the ups and downs of markets. I don't want to see my balance go down. Are primary candidates for annuities. But know that annuities are not for everyone. Nor should they be offered up carte blanche to all investors. I, as a registered investment advisor representative, do not offer them carte blanche to all clients. They're just, in my opinion, not fit for all clients. I find that certain investors will come forward and ask me for an annuity because they've heard something about them, and others don't really know a lot and they have to be explained as to how they work. As an advisory, me, a representative, I am approached by annuity companies trying to get me to offer their version. But honestly, I have found only a small handful of annuities that I find advantageous, but most annuities I find too complicated for investors. Sure, I could place a complicated annuity with a client, but I wouldn't do that knowing the client doesn't fully understand how it operates. Have I seen that done before? I will leave that to your imagination to answer that question. Truthfully, some annuities are so complicated, I have to study them for an hour or two in order to fully understand them. And I'm in the business. I am licensed to sell annuities. The annuities that I lean toward are the ones that are straightforward and simple. Straightforward and simple. The terms are clear. And they're usually not a whole lot of terms compared to some of the others I've seen, which have so many terms, so many hooks. Like I said, I got to get my tackle box out. My thinking is if I can explain a contract to a client, and the client understands how it works, it will be better for all concerned. All concerned being you, the investor, the advisor, me, my company that I work for, the advisor, registered investment advisor company, and the insurance company who's writing the contract. The annuities I lean toward are straight and simple. I will say that the regulations and oversight on annuities is severe. They're very strict, they're onerous, and they offer much protection to the consumer. And the protection regulations and oversight, although I think sometimes they're a pain to fill out because they have a lot of forms, a lot of questions. I basically got to crawl inside you and look at every inside of your fingernails to know if it's appropriate to place an annuity with you. But the annuity used to be regarded as kind of like a black box, and that's why they had to regulate, and people were selling these things like crazy. Not so today as far as the regulations and oversights. They're much better. Annuities were regarded one of the black boxes of financial products, but not so today. Many are simple, they're easy to understand, and they perform as promised. The importance of understanding annuities by both the client, you, and the advisor, me, is tantamount to a successful placement, and an honest and straightforward conversation by both parties is the cornerstone of the success of the placing of an annuity. That being said, again, investors should consider carefully the investment objectives, risks, fees, and expense before investing. For this and all other important information about a contract, please obtain the investment company funds prospectus and disclosure documents from your rep advisor. Read this information carefully before advising. Guarantees are based on claims of the paying ability of the issuing company. Now, you notice I gave that disclaimer twice because in writing I had to make it bold. Regulators said, you know, that disclaimer has to be bigger or in bold typing or in italic. It's got to be different so people will read it. So in doing it audio version, like today, I have read it twice to you and with emphasis. So hopefully the regulators will see that I have made every attempt to be compliant, as they say. Okay. Now, and we're talking about building a portfolio. You know, how do you build a portfolio? In fact, I just had a client that came forward, a potential client, not a client yet, who gave me his expenses and what he holds and how much he makes and how old he is and all his financial information, and he wants him to build him a portfolio. And he came to me and he said, I assume your portfolio is going to be very similar to the other advisor that I'm petitioning to. And I said, no. My portfolio is probably going to be different than his. So how do you build a portfolio? Building a portfolio is important. What do you do to build one? You have to consider, how many children the person has, if they're children that are dependents. Maybe they have a special needs person. Maybe they have a giant inheritance coming. Maybe they have a Social Security that is a real high payment or not such a high payment, or CalSTRS or CalPERS. Maybe they have a lot of savings. Maybe they don't. Maybe they plan to buy a winery or $100,000 RV and travel around the world. Maybe they plan to buy a house in 2 years. Maybe they don't. Maybe they have real high living expenses, but they're going to sell their house and move and not have very many expenses. So there's a lot of things what we do to build a portfolio. And diversification, MPT, modern portfolio theory, you can look it up on the web, is that diversification is the way to go and not be overloaded in any one security, every one type of asset, overloaded in an annuity or overloaded in bonds or overloaded in stocks. You spread it out over a wide variety. And it just doesn't mean, in my opinion, buying 90% stocks. And a lot of times I will see that. Somebody come to me and it'd be different ages, different situations, and they're 90% in stocks. Buy the same advisor, and I'd be like, that doesn't make any sense. Everybody's different, so everybody's portfolio should be different, in my opinion. So building a portfolio first involves conversation between you and me, or your advisor and you, a very in-depth conversation. They're going to ask a lot of questions. I'm going to ask a lot of questions. I expect the truth. I can ask you. You could lie. I wouldn't know. But I recommend that you tell the truth, because for the advisor to set up a portfolio for your needs, for your expectations, and for your risk tolerance, it's important that this conversation be thorough and lengthy. And it's a pain, but, you know, we do it over Starbucks coffee, and you kind of tell a joke in between, and there you go. Here's my joke in between the conversation. When I was growing up, there was a magic shop right on the corner, and one day it just disappeared. Was that funny? Here's another one. What's a Scotsman have under his kilt? I'm not going to answer that one. My 14-year-old son wrote that one. Last one was, I told my wife she painted her eyebrows too high. She looked surprised. Okay. 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 So we'll go on. So building portfolio is important, more important, and none of them should be the same, in my opinion. So when you want to build a portfolio, expect a lot of questions, and you should be asked a lot of questions. And, you know, I've seen, you know, the reports that advisors give out, and, you know, they say you're going to need this much of this much. I guess they have some value. You know, I don't use them myself. I can pretty much sit down and we can talk because the reports are reports. Reports are like companies that go out and say, give me your sales quota. I was never a fan of sales quota. I know company managers and West regional managers always like sales quotas. I think sales quotas are ridiculous. I think a lot of reports projecting how much money you're going to need is ridiculous because you don't know. You don't know what's going to happen in your life. And more importantly, you don't know the level of inflation. If the person you're talking to is using the level of inflation is given by the government, I will ask you, is the level of inflation that you read in the newspaper, is that, do you think that level of inflation is accurate, what you're seeing? So you leave that answer to yourself and you can ask that, answer that question. So I often get asked, how, when you have a portfolio, how do you preserve gains when the markets fall? How do you preserve your gains so you don't make $100,000 and then lose it all when the markets fall? Knowing how to deal with market falls, fits, spurts, is key to preserving capital, right? How do you preserve your gains? And saving what you made when the market has gone up. Since we are all in the market to make money, unless you're psychotic. In other words, if you're normal, you're in the market to have more later than you had when you really went in. Keeping gains when you have them as markets fall is akin to making sure you just don't give it back when Mr. Market throws a hissy fit. Since one never knows when the market will fall, by how much and when it will stop, having a strategy of some sorts is a prudent idea. Having an exit strategy, and we have talked about exit strategies so many times on this show, you should be yawning at this portion of the newscast. But I will go on for those that are new listeners or forgot, that have CRS, can't remember something. There are many strategies, but most, if not all, involve selling out something, either partially or entirely, when your trigger points are hit. What's a trigger point? Well, a trigger point could be when I lose 10%, I'm out. Or when a particular stock drops to 185, I'm out. Or when a particular stock drops 10%, I'm out. Or when the Dow drops 2%, I'm out. Or when the Dow hits 24,000, I'm out. Whatever the trigger point is. Trigger points are a mental milestone where you have agreed to get out, or your advisor has agreed with you to get out in some way or another, and adopt a stance that might not get hit so hard, or may even gain when the markets fall. There are positions that historically may gain when the markets fall. You can make money, may make money, can, not guaranteed, in market falls. One strategy, as I mentioned, might be a percentage point where you could agree that, let's say, your portfolio has gains of whatever. When the gains are given back by 50% or whatever the point is you set, in other words, I made this amount of money, if I give back half, I'm out. Entirely. I'm out. That's a simple strategy anyone can implement, although it may not be the best. It is a strategy. Example, let's say you started with $100,000. It makes $20,000 in gains, and your portfolio is worth $120,000. Okay, you made $20,000 in gains. So if you lose 10, your portfolio falls to 110, you sell out, and you've kept the 10. So you started with 100, went to 120, fell to 110, and you got out. Like I said, you could also tie the trigger to an index, such as the Dow or the NASDAQ or whatever you want. You know, it could be, Dow drops 400 points. The percentages could be anything you selected or your advisor, and there's an infinite number of combinations you could adopt, right? When this stock drops 1%, I'll get out. This one drops 2%, I'll get out, whatever. The key is whatever method you decide on, the reason you are doing it is to retain at least some of the gains you have made. Another method could be partially selling out some stocks instead of a complete sellout. You could say, well, if something starts to drop by a certain point, I'll sell half. This would convert stocks or whatever you held into cash. Or you could just go to more and more cash if the market sells off. Cash increase, a cash increase and a stock decrease would mean that the portfolio experiences less and less overall volatility. So as this market drops, you could start to go to more and more cash. Once you go to 100% cash, the portfolio will not move up or down. You could also start swapping out stocks for fixed income. That's a more fancy term there. Fixed income are things that pay a, you know, stated interest rate. Bonds or preferred stocks are some fixed income investments or others. Fixed income, although no guarantee they will offset market routes, historically, they have been regarded as anti-stock market, if I could use such a term. The old belief used to be when markets go up, when stocks go up, bonds go down. When bonds go down, stocks go up. That is not a, you know, guaranteed horse in the barn strategy, but historically it has proved to be successful in many cases. An investor could also buy what we call maybe an inverse fund or a hedge fund, not a contrary fund. Don't look for those terms specifically. Basically what I'm trying to say is you could buy things that are geared to go up when the market goes down. There are such things that are geared to go up when the market goes down. If the market goes up, these will usually geared to go down. Okay, they're geared negatively to the market. No matter what method you consider, the point is, I think it's prudent to have one of these trigger points, stops, some sort of strategy if the market falls that you want to, you know, be careful. The point is here is not to give all your gains back when the market sells off or stop, you know, tremendous setback losses and to protect a portfolio from a devastating setback. An experienced financial advisor can discuss a variety of protections, enabling you to perhaps sleep better at night knowing your money is at least somewhat defensive in posture if things go south, right? Things go south, and Washington does something crazy, I won't lose it all. Keep in mind, investing involves risk in exchange for the possibility of gains, right? Right, right. You could put your money in a savings account, but the possibility for gains are minimal. So investing in other things besides savings or CDs that are guaranteed by the U.S. government, investing in other things involves risk, and you take on the risk in exchange for the possibility of more gains. And although there are a variety of methods available to help protect you, there are no guarantees that any of these will work as planned. If an investor cannot accept any risk whatsoever, U.S. government guaranteed savings accounts, bank CDs, and things as U.S. Treasuries and other debt instruments by the U.S. government are available and are deemed as risk-free. Certain ones. Okay, we'll be back to Money Matters on your community radio station. My name's Mark Cuniberti. Hang tight. Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Yeah. and the tax man. Real quick, KV Mars 40th birthday party. KV Mars 40th birthday party. Wow. Pinder Park this Saturday, 3:30 to 10. Tickets, $10 at the gate, $5 for veterans and youth, 15 and under, $5. Information at kvmar.org, of course, or 530-265-9073. Food, vendors, party. Music by Buck Love and the Humperheads, Huffer Bells, Achilles Wheel Trio, Brandy Robinson, Grease, Grit, and Grime, Paul Campanella, McDonald, Saul, and Elena Rayo. So, but party this Saturday, 40th. You party for KV Mark, come on and say hello. Okay, so I was going to talk about solar today, but we don't have enough time, so I'm going to talk about financial leverage. Leverage. Have you heard the term? Leverage. Leverage comes from the word lever, right? So when you want to lift a big couch, you can't do it. You get a big lever, and you get a little one-inch thing under the couch, and you get a nine-inch bar on your end, and that's leverage. Physics, amazing science. You can study why does a lever make you stronger and able to lift a couch that you normally wouldn't lift, basically because you're transferring some of the energy to the floor. The longer the bar, what happens is you're kind of like gearing a bicycle. When you have a real long bar, you are putting 7 or 8 feet worth of movement into moving something an inch up. So you have a short bar, you move 4 inches, and the couch moves up an inch. It's pretty hard to do. But you have a 9-inch bar, you are moving the bar down like 9 feet, but you're only lifting the couch an inch or two, and therefore the energy you're using to move the couch is an extended period of energy. So that's how leverage works in lifting a couch with a long rod, you know, crowbar or whatever. So the term leverage in financial circles, right, the term leverage in financial circles means kind of the same thing, that you're accomplishing of an investment with more money than you have. So the term leverage in financial circles means investing money, wagering, some might say, partially using someone else's money for part of the investment funds. So what does that mean? Well, suppose an investor or company wants to invest in a security or maybe a store or something, and you put up $100 and you get $100 worth of stock back. There's no leverage in that investment, okay? One to one, right? No leverage. I put up $100, I get $100 IOU. No leverage. You put up $100, you get $100 worth of value. Now, the investment where you could use leverage could be anything, a share of stock, an investment in a business or property or whatever might be available. Now, imagine case two. Situation number two. The same investor or company puts up $100, but it wants to receive $1,000 worth of value. You put up $100, but I want $1,000 worth of value. In essence, $900 of the investment must be covered by someone else. You only have $100, but you want to buy $1,000 worth. Think of buying a house. You put down a down payment, you take a loan for the rest. That's leverage. You're receiving more in value. You receive more in value than you put up in cash. Leverage is available to stock investors, sometimes to what is called a margin account. With a brokerage firm, once you are approved and they hold your account, you may be allowed to borrow funds from the brokerage account to increase the amount of your investment. Usually they charge an interest rate. Some may charge you a fee. Usually it's an interest rate. There are various examples of leverage throughout the financial community that might not encompass an individual investor. An investment company might borrow money to invest in another company. Or a company like ABZ Cleaner Company might borrow money to buy CDF Cleaning Company. A bond fund might use leverage to increase its amount of bonds. In other words, it puts up $1 billion, it buys $10 billion worth of bonds. And that way it gets interest on $10 billion worth of bonds. So it's used as leverage to get more return. Or an investor like you or Joe Smith of Main Street USA might want to buy more of an investment than he has money for. In all cases, someone else besides the initial investing entity, whether it be a company buying somebody or a hedge fund buying something or an investor buying something, someone other than that in the entity is loaning money to that entity. Leverage is used to hopefully increase returns that otherwise might be garnered from using the original amount. So, an example, an investor might believe that stock ABC might increase in value, and he only has enough money to buy 100 shares, but he wants to buy more because he's, quote, sure in his brain, although that can't be possible, you're never sure, he's sure that'll go up, but he only has 100 bucks. So he puts up 100 bucks, and we'll assume that the shares are a buck a share. So he puts up 100 bucks and he gets 100 shares. But then he goes to his brokerage company and he says, I want to buy 900 more. So he buys 900 more shares. And then the brokerage company lends him $900 to buy the other 900 shares that he didn't have money for. In this case, the amount of the loan is $900. And the investor gets 1,000 shares. He's got $100 in it. He borrowed 900. He's got 1,000 shares. If the transaction is completed and all that goes through, the investor owns 1,000 shares. But he owes the firm $900. Now, suppose the stock doubles in value. Okay? The original shares were a buck a share. Now they're $2 a share. So they're worth $2,000. Since the investor only put up $100 and he owes $900, if he sells everything, he's got to pay back the $900. He's got his original $100 and he's got $1,000 that he made in profit. What's that? 1,000% gain or whatever it is? Yeah, I think it's 1,000% gain. So he made $1,000 on $100 because he borrowed $900 of it. Not too shabby. However, the enticement of leverage is very, very seductive. And the big boys know that all too well. Leverage on a humongous scale can contribute to some sizable gains. Think maybe J.P. Morgan or Bank of America or whoever who go to the Feds and borrow a lot of money. A lot of zeros. But the knife edge of leverage is two-sided. Suppose our $100 investor, he who borrowed a $900, saw the shares drop by 10%. Okay? So, 10% of the $1,000 is $100. Right? So the stock dropped only 10%. But the 10% that it dropped wiped out $100. Right? 10% of $1,000. So the investor is, in essence, wiped out on a 10% move. Since $100 is all he has in the game, the rules say if your position, I'm the bank or the brokerage company, if your position loses what you invested, which is $100, we're selling you out because we don't want to lose money, and you owe us this money. Now, if it moves fast, you can get really in trouble. But the danger of this is a 10% move can wipe you out if you've borrowed $900 on a $1,000 investment, right? Ouch. So goes the good, bad, and the ugly of using leverage. One only has to look back at the near financial collapse of the entire global system in 08 and 09 to just see how leverage can ratchet up the losses in a hurry with nowhere to run should the underlying asset fall rapidly. In other words, a lot of these banks and mortgages, everybody was leveraged to the hilt, and bonds, everybody was leveraged to the hilt, and stock market dropped, what, 10, 20, 30, 40%, and all of a sudden the world's coming to an end. I mean, since if the stock market dropped 50%, you know, then how come Brian Williams comes on and says in August of 08 or 09, I can't remember when, Brian Williams comes on NBC and says, incredibly, Citibank is near the brink. Well, you could say, well, it's only a 40% drop. Citibank should only be 40% down because they were ratcheted up. They were levered. They had the bar out. They were levered. Hence the trepidation of world banks, central banks. Hence the trepidation of world central banks when moving things in the market. Even small moves by the Federal Reserve can cause huge problems on a leveraged economy. Right? If everybody was in it with 100%, market could move all around, probably no problem. But when everybody's geared up through things like derivatives or just standard leverage or bonds or whatever it is, you move the market with like an interest rate change a little bit, you can cause major problems. Knowing full well the tool of leverage is used on a grand scale by financial institutions everywhere, monetary authorities like central banks are well aware of the damage leverage can cause when used on the massive scale that they are. When individuals use leverage, it can wipe out their portfolio in a hurry. When global financial institutions use it, it has the possibility of wiping out not only individual investors, but world banking systems as well. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. We have time for one phone call. Good afternoon. You're live on the air with Money Matters. How are you?
Hey, how's it going, Mark?
I'm doing fine. How are you? Who's this?
This is Eric.
Hey, Eric. What's your question?
Hey. Well, my question was, I just wanted to put a plug in for internet for finding out inflation, true inflation numbers, and I don't know if you.
You can't plug anything. There's no plugs. I can say that if someone wants to see someone's opinion of the true a method of inflation, you can go to shadowstats.com. Is that what you were going to say?
Yeah.
I got it, man.
There
I got you covered,
go.
Dude. Thanks for your phone call. I'm way ahead of you. You got to get up pretty early in the morning to fool me, boo. All right, Eric. Take care.
I know that, Mark.
Ah, yeah. Yeah. Right. Shadowstats.com. is what he's referring to. John Williams actually runs ShadowStats.com, and I interviewed him, 10, 12, 14 years ago. Maybe I'll bring that interview in. So, yeah, hey, man, couldn't fool me, Eric. John Williams runs ShadowStats.com. You can check that out and see John Williams' opinion of where inflation is based on different metrics. I can tell you comfortably that the U.S. government has changed its method of evaluating inflation many times. And the common belief is it started in the Johnson era, Lyndon Johnson era, and it's gone from there, and they keep changing it. So, the fact they changed Social Security to the chain CPI instead of a CPI, and that's kind of a more involved thing, but a chain CPI was now applied to Social Security payments, which means over time, you'll likely get less. What a surprise, huh?
I'm on Fried Jack, keep your hands off of my stack.
That concludes the 272nd edition of Money Matters Today. All shows are published a gratia at moneymanagementradio.com, where everything is free, our way of saying thank you for listening to your community radio station. Of course, remember, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Views expressed in my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff members, or underwriters. So that concludes the show. I want to thank you. You've listened to show 272. You can hear it in about a week on the website, moneymanagementradio.com. Contact your program director of this station you are hearing the show on. For all the great programming of your community radio station or information, they can contact me, Just go to the program director, say, send an email to Mark, and they'll be able to do that for you. Great stuff coming up on the radio, so just stay tuned. It was my pleasure. God bless. Have a great day.